Dishes, Marina, actually, sir. Bishulakum is our topic for today. Food which is cooked by non-Jewish people. Hazal made a gezeirah that we don't eat such food, subject to certain conditions. And there are two main reasons given for this gezeirah. Number one, Rashi says in Avodah Zarah Lamed Hay, Le'esrachek me'anochrim shelo yis'aru b'hem yisroel, that we minimize the amount of socializing we're doing with Gentiles, because otherwise we are worried about intermarriage. There is a second reason given, k'day shelo yisroel rogel etzlo b'machol v'mishteh, that they are not engage socially with each other on a frequent basis, that the non-Jewish person might mix something which is not kosher into the food. So there are really two reasons. Rashi also gives the second reason in the Gemara Lamed Ches, and this is the reason of the Ora Zerua in Siman Kuf Tzadi Aleph. Tosfos, pardon? We're worried that the non-Jewish person who's doing the cooking might mix something which is not kosher into the food, or he won't care so much about kashrus where something gets mixed up inadvertently, and therefore we have a kashrus problem. Tosfos regard this reason as the more important one. But the Tosfos disagrees, and the Rambam writes in Hilchos Ma'acholos Asuros, in Perek Yudzai, in Halacha Tes, that the reason for Bishulakum is to prevent intermarriage. And the Rambam regards that as the primary reason. Now, I once said to the Mashgiach in Gates of Yeshiva, Reb Mati Sio Solomon, you know, why did Chazal have to give us such a far-reaching takona? You know, I said, the people who are not so from the Reform, who are breakaways, they're the ones who are intermarrying. And amongst us, Heimish Achevra, I mean, intermarriage you don't see, and are we likely to just marry out just because of the food which is being served on the yeshiva table? And he said to me, don't kid yourself. Don't fool yourself into thinking that intermarriage isn't a test which happens to unzere chevra, to us in our own orthodox spheres. It can happen, he said, to anybody. And it led me to think about a postcard which was written. We have a collection of postcards in our family, written by my great-grandfather to my grandfather. My grandfather came over from Poland in 1901 or thereabouts to escape from the Polish army, and he came over at the tender age of 16. This was my father's father, and his father wrote to him, don't work with non-Jewish people because we're worried you might end up intermarrying. And it was unbelievable. They came over in such a Heimish way and dressed in such a Heimish way, and it was furthest thing from their minds, but this was a worry which my great-grandfather had in the year 1901. And in my own experience, somebody came to me, somebody who was attending a shir of mine, a weekly shir, a frum young man, an admirable, very nice young man, came to me, this was already 20 years ago, and he said to me, look, I've got something to confess to you. Yes, what is it? He said, I've got involved with a non-Jewish girl. And he said, I'm finding it very difficult to break off the relationship with her. So I chatted with him as best I could, and I said, look, you know, there are times in life when you have to amputate a limb of a body to save a life. It didn't help. All the logic which I tried to discuss with him did not help. We'll call this fellow Moish for the time being. And I said to Moish, look, you know, Hitler tried to do away with the Jewish people. He failed. But if you marry this girl, you are succeeding where Hitler failed. You are doing away with the Jewish people. It's not an idea of racism. It's simply that we wish to preserve our Jewish heritage. However much logic I put into him didn't help. So I suggested to him that he goes on a nice holiday somewhere, preferably to Eretz Yisrael, and he took up the idea. He went to Israel, and it was the first time in his life that he went there, and he was greatly overwhelmed by his experiences there. He went to the Kosel, he went to other Makomos HaKadoshim, and it had an effect on him, an emotional effect on him. And while he was there, he visited a very elderly relation, a great aunt, who was already in her 90s. And there was something she said to him, which gave him quite a shock. She said to him, "You know, it's a big shame what happened in your family to your great-grandfather, isn't it?" He said, "My great-grandfather?" "Yes. Don't you know?" "Oh yes, he pretended, just so that she carries on talking." "Yes, of course I know, but tell me the details. Don't you know that he married who your mother's mother's mother, he married out?" "Oh, my mother's mother's mother? She wasn't Jewish." "She wasn't Jewish. And what happened was, she died when her daughter was only 2 years old, and his great-grandfather remarried to a Jewish woman who brought up this girl in the Jewish way, and she said she was your grandmother." Well, you can imagine what a shock this fellow got. Before you went to Israel, I actually was talking to Rav Cooper Schlitter about this case, and he thought, well, you know, if we can do whatever we can, we have to try very hard, and he convinced me to put my pressure on him. Anyway, he came back from Eretz Yisrael and he said to me, "Look, this is what I found out," and I said, "Well, this is a bit much for me to handle," but he came to this sudden feeling of a vacuum, that when he realized that halakhically he might not be Jewish at all, well, he then decided, "I'm going to become Jewish. I can't imagine life without being Jewish." And he decided there and then to cut off all relationships with this non-Jewish girl and to become Jewish. And we went together to Rabbi Cooper, and Rabbi Cooper phoned up the Beis Din, and we went together to the Beis Din, who beforehand asked him if he could find any documents, his parents' ksuva and his grandparents' ksuva, and he rummaged through his parents' drawers whilst they were out, and he actually managed to find the ksuvas that they got married in the United Synagogue. And we went round to the Beis Din, and we sat with a dayan, and the dayan had beforehand fished out records and found the records in their offices relating to his parents' and his grandparents' marriage, and attached to his grandparents' details of marriage there was a letter from the dayan on the Beis Din at that time in the early 1930s. This is to confirm that the young lady who is getting married on Tuesday next has been duly admitted to the Jewish community, Kedosha Chedin, and has therefore been given the name, whatever, Bas Avraham Avinu, and she may therefore get married. So the problem was known, the problem was dealt with, but it was just a little letter which was stuck, and he said to me afterwards, he said, "You know, Eli, it was a big shock to find out that I wasn't Jewish, but it was an even bigger surprise to find out that I was." But he needed some emotional shock to get him moving, to get him away from this experience. How easy it is to fall into the realm of intermarriage. Everybody here probably knows somebody who fell into that trap. And Chazal had a deep insight into safeguarding us against these pitfalls. And they realized that it can come about easily by socializing with food and with drink. We know about the din of wine, stam yenom, not to drink wine from non-Jewish sources. And we have today the din of bishurakum. And we've discussed those two reasons, and they made two provisos. Bishurakum does not apply if the food can be eaten raw. What if that food can be eaten raw is a less chashivos, it's a less importance of the food when it's cooked. We're talking about food which is important. And there's a second reason, and that is it only applies to food which is ole b'shulchan melochim, what is served at a royal table. If you're going to Buckingham Palace and you see what the Queen would be serving to you at her banquet or at a garden party, that is the kind of food which would apply shulchan melochim. So the question is, do we say that the din of bishulachim applies just to one of these reasons, or do we say it's to both? Namely, that the food can only be eaten cooked and not if it's raw, and ole b'shulchan melochim. The Shulchan Aruch rules that it's both those reasons together, even though the opinion of the Ramban is that it could be either. And the Ritva says, even if it's not normally eaten raw, which might be a different kind of category. Now what do we mean by ole b'shulchan melochim? You get various foods like cereals, which has on it an insignia, by appointment to Her Majesty the Queen, Prince Charles, lady this, lady that. If you have this insignia, does that mean it's ole b'shulchan melochim? So it was Rav Kuklo Shlita originally said to me that he didn't think that the insignia itself gave it the category of Shulchan Malachim.
There was a picture in the paper of the Queen's breakfast table.
Yes.
And there was a box of cornflakes.
Box of cornflakes. But the question is, this isn't simply whether the Queen eats cornflakes. Would Her Majesty serve you with cornflakes if she invites you to a banquet at the palace? And that is why the question arises. And in the yeshiva world, you see all the breakfast cereals on the table. And I discussed breakfast cereals once with Rav Cooper, and he felt that there were certain heterim, which we'll be discussing in a moment, which allowed the various cereals. And I can see we got cornflakes on the table today. And he quoted to me a shach. Oh, it's got the hefshah on it. Oh, wow. He quoted to me a shach, which... He quoted to me a shach which says, if the person who manufactures it is not personally known to you, then there is a heter. Like factories, they employ lots of workers. The idea of bishulakam is intimacy, where the woman is cooking specially for you in your honor, and you are acquainted with this lady, then we are worried about intermarriage. But if you have no concept whatsoever about who made it, about some worker in the factory, there is such a heter. Although Rav Cooper told me that he preferred to eat puffed wheat, which was not a proper cooking process. But the Maharit says that it's okay if you are not acquainted with the cook. And various heterim arise from this. For example, can you eat tinned salmon? John West, you see it in the kosher shops. It's made by non-Jewish people. And the Birk HaYosef brings down in Kuf Yud Beis Sif Tes from the Maharit that there is a heter based on the principle of pas plata, which is an inyan of bread, which is a separate takana we'll discuss if we've got time. We're more strict with Bishulakum, but the general halacha is that we're lenient, and the Shemet Halevi says this in Simon Kuf Ches of Chelek Rov of his Tshuvas, but the Chazon Ish, he says, was machmir. If one can be machmir, Tavol of Baruch. So there is the idea of Shulchan Melachim. Are potatoes Shulchan Melachim? Some views I express, the Daiki Tshuva says, well, for a long time potatoes were regarded as a food for poor people, but nowadays potatoes and the way they're embellished may well be served on Shulchan Melachim. Rice is regarded as Shulchan Melachim. Meat and fish, yes?
Does the pasteurizing process where you put the tin and you superheat it for a fraction of a second?
I haven't seen any tshuva about pasteurizing with in respect of bishulakum, but I don't think pasteurizing is a proper bishul. Certainly we say there's a question on Stam Yenom whether pasteurization constitutes cooked wine. There is a difference of opinion about that. I don't think that pasteurizing would have an effect, because it's not a proper cooking process. There are questions about smoking procedure. I mean, the salmon you have is smoked, and those poskim seem to say that something which is smoked is not called bishulakum, but something which is steamed may well be. Roasting certainly, fried certainly.
Is that as a method of actually cooking the salmon? Would that not count? For example, salmon, to cook the salmon this way, it's smoked. To cook kippers, for example, they are smoked. Would that then count?
I have seen one or two sources which regard Ishun smoked as a bishulakum, but most opinions I've seen are saying it's not bishulakum, and there is a general trend nowadays to a heter on this. What about foods like hummus and falafel? The Aruch HaShulchan and the Daiki Tshuva write about these foods. They're not regarded as bishulakum because they're not called Shulchan Melachim. Chocolate, believe it or not, is not regarded as Shulchan Melachim. The Aruch HaShulchan says, well, it's changed its format anyway, and he says it's not a proper food, chocoholics, please note. The Shomer Tzion of Halacha talks about sardines. He wouldn't regard them as Bishulakum, and he also talks about Rice Krispies, interestingly enough. He says they're not properly cooked, and it's not usual to eat them on their own, but with milk, so he said it's not a royal food.
What I understand is if the If the reason is because they might mix something in with it, what difference does it make whether it's cooked properly or not?
You're right. There are two reasons given that are shown in. There is, in fact, a third reason about if it's changing its format. But the primary reason of the Rambam is intermarriage, and that is the general trend of the Achronim as well. But there is that reason as well. We're worried about some food being mixed in. But it doesn't apply to all foods. But yes, I mean, once you bring that argument to its logical conclusion, you can say it applies to a salad. Because a salad, the non-Jewish people, they put bits of chicken in their salads, or chazer they put in their salads. So you could say that you can't eat a non-Jewish salad, but the takana of bishulakum does not apply to salads. And it only applies to olal shulchan melachim and food which can't be eaten raw. So the raw principle we can also discuss. If a food is very sour when it's raw, but it can still be eaten, there are certain kinds of dates, the Shulchan Aruch writes about this, then Bishulakum does not apply. But what about cooking apples, apples which you only normally eat when they're cooked and not when they're raw? We paskin that you're allowed to eat those when they're cooked as Bishulakum. Wine, milk, honey, oil, all regarded as okay. But there are interesting differences of opinion nowadays in the Kadassia establishment. The present Rosh Beis Din has told the caterers not to use corn unless it has a heksher. Corn, when I say corn, I mean maize corn. Whereas his predecessor, who was his father, Zatzal, did allow corn to be used without a heksher from the cans. So the question is this, and the Chidor addresses this question. When do we say the raw principle? He says it's according to the majority's behavior. When most people eat a food which is raw, then it's not subject to bishulakum. And the royalty principle is not simply according to what most people do. The Chidos says in the Shalos Tshuvos Chaim Sha'ol, Chelek Aleph, Simon Ayin Dalet, he says the royalty principle goes according to the minhag hamokom, the custom of the place. So in England you might have a different custom than to America or to France or to Turkey as to whether a food is ola al shulchan melachim. And this is hinted at in the Rambam, because the Rambam, he says, b'mokom she'osin al shulchan melachim, in the place where it is served on shulchan melachim, that is where the din of bishul akum applies. Now, the Machlokas Rishonim extends further into whether this cooking is taking place inside a Jewish house. There are opinions that if you have the cooking taking place in your own home, and the obvious question is if you have a maid or an au pair who is doing cooking for you, does the din of Bishulakum apply? And nowadays also you've got the problem with restaurants where they employ non-Jewish staff. So you say, well, I don't know who these people are, and they're not doing it personally for me. Does the din of Bishulakum apply as well? And then we bring this further, if we're talking about where you don't know the cook, what about vegetarian restaurants? The question there arises as well. Now, everything I'm saying today is the halacha v'lo lemaaseh, and personal queries should always be forwarded to one's own competent rabbinical authority, who we have in this shul, of course. But there are some general principles. If we just mention vegetarian restaurants, it's more complicated than one thinks, because it's not just a question of bishulakum. There, vegetarian restaurants use cheese, and there is a separate din on gevinas akum. You're not allowed to eat non-Jewish cheese, even though it's kosher, unless it has some sort of supervision and hechsher, because there is a separate gezeirah which Chazal made about cheese. When we talk about cheese, we mean the hard cheese. What about vegetables which might be infested and they're not checked? What about the fact that the vegetarian restaurants bring in bread and cakes from other sources, and the way they are prepared, for them it's called vegetarian, but for us it's not, because of the way their tins have been greased with animal fats. And throughout this country the bread is prepared normally with animal fats greasing. On the continent it's different, and you can get local rabbinates like in Switzerland who will tell you that there are certain breads that you are allowed to eat when you travel to those places, which are made in non-Jewish places, but it's known that they don't grease their tins. On the subject of bread, there is a different rule called pas akum, but that never applied to all places, and Chazal were worried that this can cause undue hardship and even starvation if they apply rigidly the din of pas akum. And the Shulchan Aruch says we make a chumra in the aseres, you make teshuva not to eat pas akum. But the general trend of the din of bread baked in non-Jewish sources is not as severe as bishul akum, whereas bishul akum is more of a luxury food because it's ola shulchan melachim, etc. So that can be various problems. The vegetarian restaurants also serve soups which are from manufactured powders from sources unknown to them, and those mix in some non-Jewish, there are I think certain Swiss soups which the vegetarian shops sell here, which are not, which are in Switzerland, not on the approved list because of non-Jewish ingredients. Then there are the ice creams which have emulsifiers and other ingredients which by law they don't even have to list in the ingredients. So there are numerous problems which can arise in those categories of vegetarian restaurants. And they might be cooked with wine, you're quite right. So there are various problems there, but what about the maid in the house? The Or HaShem quotes the Ramban, Ein isu b'shvachos halolu hakunuyos lo. When you acquire a maid, and the question is, what does it mean when you acquire? It's not like the old type slavery, or is it? The meleches de eved b'yisrael hu dekonu lo b'maisa yodov muchsalov b'shabbos ma'menuchot. And you're careful on Shabbos that your maid doesn't work for you, where the Torah says your servants are not allowed to work for you on Shabbos. So it's a different category, and there is a difference in the poskim of whether you own the person or whether you have hired the person, because nowadays really you're just hiring, you're paying them by the hour or with a salary. And are you allowed to eat what they cook? The Ra'ah and the Rashbah, and the Rashbah in Shalos Tshuvas Chelek Aleph Simaches says, Onu Noagim Isur. We do say you don't eat their food, and both the opinions of allowing and not allowing are brought in the Shulchan Aruch Kuf Yud Gimel Dalet. So what do you do when the Shulchan Aruch says yes and no? The Ramah, who writes for the Ashkenazim, he says, Noagim Lahokhel. The Ramah says, our minhag in the Ashkenazim is to be more lenient. He says, it's impossible that the Jew won't do something. What will happen is, the maid is preparing the food, and the balas habayis will go in the kitchen and will stoke the coals a bit, or will light the gas, so to speak. The Jew will do something in the cooking process, and if one switches off the oven or lights the gas or whatever, then we will say it's not called bishul akum. And that is the sort of hetter which is generally used in the kosher restaurants and amongst the caterers. There is another idea that the Levush writes. The maid feels inferior to the employer. So there isn't this kiruv das, this familiarity, and the kalas rosh and the frivolity which might result between the employer and the employee, which is what Chazal were worried about when it comes to familiarity and intermarriage. And therefore it's not so likely. And also there is the idea that the maid will be worried about the dominance of the boss, and will be scared to mix in something which is non-kosher, because otherwise the maid or cook might lose their job. And that is another idea which the Levush writes. So that leans towards a heter, and the minhag of the Ashkenazim therefore is to be more lenient about it, and the Sephardim are generally more strict when it comes to having something like a maid in the house. However, Rav Avadya Yosef, who writes for the Sephardim, and he writes in Sefer Halichas Olam in Perek Zayin, Kuf Chaf Beis, he says also the Sephardim can rely on the hotels and the restaurants which are under a Hechsher, even though the cook is not Jewish, where the Mashgiach will be lighting the oven or switching on the cooker. And then he says, V'amachmir tava alav brocha, but it's very nice if one is able to be strict on the matter. What about instant foods, like these powdery foods, where you buy them from non-Jewish sources, but you have to do something to them to make them into their final format? I suppose cocoa powder is something like that. Pardon? Mashed potatoes. And there seems to be a general heter on that, because you are doing something essential in the cooking process. I can't believe the Queen would be serving you powdered mashed potato.
The credit crunch.
What about if there's a mixture? Actually, the one question which came to me when I was looking at dinim about bishul akum was it's understood quite easily that fish is something which is ole al shulchan melachim. It served at royal banquets. But nowadays it's become fashionable to eat this Japanese food called sushi. And sushi is made with raw fish. So if fish is something which can be eaten raw, and it could be any kind of fish, then surely the din of bishulakum doesn't apply to fish. So I spoke to a certain Rav about this, and he said, oh, these mishkaners who want to eat raw fish. he felt that it was only a minority who do such a thing, and there is a principle we've discussed about, if it goes to the minority, well, then it still applies. I have since found out that proper sushi is really mainly rice, which is steamed, and only there's a small part inside it. So you've got a mixture. And what is the din when you have a mixture? And the Gemara discusses this. The Gemara talks about kasa taharasanot, and this is raw fish mixed with a flour mix. And that flour, of course, you can't eat when it's raw. And the Gemara says, since most of the food is flour, therefore there is a din of bishul akum, because you go basarov according to the majority. And it seems with sushi, most of the food is rice. And bishul akum applies to rice. The rice is steamed. So therefore, even if you won't apply the din of bishul akum to the fish put in sushi, it's in the minority anyway. I have also found out that the kosher caterers, they're not using raw fish. They're using smoked salmon, and they're cheating because they know that Unzer Chever won't eat the proper Japanese stuff of raw fish. But in those circumstances, we can see that the din would apply in any case to fish. Now, what about coffee? What about beer? We did once discuss the subject of beer in a complete shiur. The Pri Chodosh says that since these drinks are mainly water, and water is obviously okay, and water is the rove, he says bishul akum does not apply. So bishul akum does not apply to beer, and beer doesn't come within the original takana of yayin. It wasn't even around at that time. So you're allowed to drink non-Jewish beer. Subject.
Therefore, you're more likely to mix with goyim.
Is that where you're more likely to mix with goyim? So the Chochmas Odom says in Samech Vav Yud Dalad, he recognizes the social dangers of drinking socially with non-Jewish people and what can lead on from that. And in particular, when it's non-Jewish premises. You know, if you go into an off-license and you bring home your beer and you're drinking it at home and you're serving it at a Shalom Zachar, okay, that's one thing. No problem. But if you are going into non-Jewish establishments and socializing with non-Jewish people, that is when the questions arise, and the Daiki Tshuva writes about this as well, which is problematic. And you know, you've got to ask a shal, if you're in an office and you're asked to come along to a pub for some leaving do, a birthday party, whatever it is, what is the din? And it's problematic. Certainly orange juices are available, but certainly by bishul akum doesn't apply to beer, but the social element and the dangers involved have to be recognized. Now, the question then we asked about Jewish participation, lighting the fire, is it good enough? There is a Gemara phrase about somebody who throws a little thorn inside the fire. So you're doing a minimal effort. If you put something inside the flames, then that might on its own be good enough, but the Rabbi Yonah and the Rivash and the Ran all say no, it's not good enough. That such a partial act is not okay. But the Beis Yosef and the Avnei Nezer say if you actually place the food on the fire, and Beis Yosef was the Sfardi, if you place the food on the fire as well as just kindling, so for the Ashkenazim, for the Ramah, it's good enough if you just kindle the fire. But the Beis Yosef said if you put the food on the flame and light it, then that's good enough. Now what about the kalim in which the food was cooked? If there was definitely bishul akum, then the kalim which were used for cooking it in become treif. You can't use those kalim in future. And they have to be kashered or whatever, if it's possible to kasher them. Because we are worried that because something forbidden was done with those kalim, you can't have such kalim afterwards. What about when food is cooked for a sick person? The Paskin bring down that the din of bishul akum does not apply if the non-Jewish person was cooking for a sick person. And this shaila can relate in a way to hospitals. Fortunately now we get kosher food in hospitals and so on. But if there isn't any kosher meals available, and somebody is in hospital, and they are serving food which one is 100% sure is kosher, like just boiled potatoes which are not mixed with anything else, then there is no din of bishul akum. And the same applies to medication. There is no din of bishul akum. It's awkward because one wants to know if anything's been mixed up with it, and that is the other idea of bishul akum. Has anything been mixed up with it? The various questions then arise, and it's sometimes difficult to know whether something comes within the category, especially nowadays with modern methods. What about microwave cooking? If you put food in a microwave, is it called cooking lahalacha? Well, the Sheva Alevi says in Chelek Ches Kufpehe that we do regard microwave cooking as bishul akum if a non-Jewish person has prepared food in this way, because it hasn't literally got to be in cooking in water, where we've got other methods like roasting and so on. Well, the question is, do we compare it to cooking in Hilchas Shabbos? Because Hilchas Shabbos, if you, let's say, cook in the heat of the sun, then it's not called cooking. But if you are cooking Toldo the Chamer, something which was heated by the sun, you then bring your doors and then heat on that, you are not allowed to use that on Shabbos. It's not quite the same parallel.
I've had people like taking when holiday Jones and Hamodis meals and asking a non-Jew to put them in the microwave.
Okay, but there you're heating them up. It's not
already cooked. That's already cooked.
I think you could say there it's already cooked,
it's
and therefore.
It's probably kosher before they
start. What's the what I'm saying is, if the mere process of microwaving, that would be a problem.
Well, there are questions about is there a bishul achabishul, and in Hilchos Shabbos sometimes there's a yesh bishul achabishul, but certainly if food has been cooked and then frozen and you're served an airline meal which is heated up by non-Jewish people, there is no din of bishul akum there. You're okay. Otherwise you're going to starve all your way to Singapore. In conclusion, we can see that Chazal had a very deep psychological insight into human behavior. They could understand that sometimes a person could fall into the trap of intermarriage. However observant that person is, the person keeps Shabbos, eats kosher food, keeps Taras HaMishpacha, and all these mitzvahs a person might be keeping. And nevertheless, we do hear sadly of stories of people who have fallen by the wayside and who have ended up marrying out. And I know somebody who deals a lot with Russian Jews, who has managed to bring Yiddishkeit into Russia in such a big way, and there was a Russian gentleman who took on himself to keep all the mitzvahs. But he said to this Rav, he says, but there's just one thing I can't do, he said, I just can't leave my wife, his non-Jewish wife. I just can't do it. Emotionally, he felt it was much too difficult. How people's emotions can rule their lives. And Chazal, having had this insight, built into the halacha these precautions, which we have to take very seriously, even though we might think that it might not apply to us in certain circumstances, we need to follow the halachic guidelines in order to be sure that we're going along with Divrei Chazal. And for every reason which Chazal did give us for their takonos, there were other reasons which they did not give us. And we have to respect what Chazal told us and keep to the letter these rules, such as Bishul Akum, such as Stam Yeinom, and these other ones we've discussed as well. Thank you very much.